Renfield takes me back to the smoking room and shuts the door. He's having a bad day, I'm afraid. She pulls out a cardboard packet and extracts a cigarette. Smoke? No thanks. The sash windows are nailed shut and their frames painted over. There's a louvered vent near the top of the windows, grossly unfit for purpose. I try not to breathe too deeply. What happened to him? She strikes a match and contemplates the flame for a moment. Let's see. He's 42. Married, 2 kids. He talks about them. Wife's a schoolteacher. His deep cover is that he works in MI6 clerical. You're not supposed to talk about your work to your partner, but it's difficult enough that we've been given dispensation to tell little white lies. And if necessary, HR will back them up. He's not field qualified. Mostly he does theory, but he worked for Q Division and he was on secondment to the Abstract Attractor Working Group when he fell ill. In other words, he's a theoretical thaumaturgist. Magic being a branch of applied mathematics, when you carry out certain computational operations, it has echoes in the Platonic realm of pure mathematics. Echoes audible to beings whose true nature I cannot speak of, on account of doing so being a violation of the Official Secrets Act. Theoretical thaumaturgists are the guys who develop new efferent algorithms, or colloquially, spells. It's an occupation with a high attrition rate. He's convinced the auditors are after him for thinking inappropriate thoughts on organisation time. There's an elaborate confabulation, and it looks a little like paranoid schizophrenia at first glance, but underneath, we sent him to our trust hospital for an MRI scan, and he's got the characteristic lesions.
Lesions?
She takes a deep drag from the cigarette. His prefrontal lobes look like Swiss cheese. It's one of the early signs of Kranzberg syndrome. If we can keep him isolated from work for a couple more months, then retire him to a nice, quiet desk job, we might be able to stabilise him. K syndrome's not like Alzheimer's. If you remove the insult, it frequently goes into remission. Mind you, he may also need a course of chemotherapy. At various times, my predecessors tried electroconvulsive treatment, prefrontal lobotomy, neuroleptics, daytime television, LSD. None of them work consistently or reliably. The best treatment still seems to be bed rest, followed by work therapy in a quiet, undemanding office environment. Blue cloud spirals toward the ceiling. But he'll never run a great summoning again. I'm beginning to regret not accepting her offer of a cigarette, and I don't even smoke. My mouth's dry. I sit down. Do we have any idea what causes K syndrome? I've skimmed Gibbous Moon, but the medical jargon didn't mean much to me, and Axiom Refuge was even less helpful. It turned out to be a dense mathematical treatise introducing a notation for describing certain categories of topological defect in a 12-dimensional space. Only the power supply for the mainframe, presumably the one Matron uses, seemed remotely relevant to the job in hand.
There are several theories.
Renfield twitches ash on the threadbare carpet as she paces the room.
It tends to hit theoretical computational demonologists after about 20 years. Merriweather is unusually young. It also hits people who've worked in high thaum fields for too long. Initial symptoms include mild ataxia. You saw his hand shaking? And heightened affect. It can be mistaken for bipolar disorder or hyperactivity. There's also the disordered thinking and auditory hallucinations typical of some types of schizophrenia.
She pauses to inhale.
There are 2 schools of thought, if you leave out the Malleus Maleficarum stuff about souls contaminated by demonic effusions. One is that exposure to high thaum fields causes progressive brain lesions. Trouble is, it's rare enough that we haven't been able to quantify that, and...
The other theory? I prod.
My favourite.
She nearly smiles.
Computational demonology. You carry out calculations, you prove theorems. Somewhere else in the Platonic realm of mathematics, listeners notice your activities and respond, yes? Well, there's some disagreement over this, but the current orthodoxy in neurophysiology is that the human brain is a computational organ. We can carry out computational tasks, yes? We're not very good at it, and at an individual neurological level there's no mechanism that might invoke the Core-Turing theorems, but if you think too hard about certain problems, you might run the risk of carrying out a minor summoning in your own head. Nothing big enough or bad enough to get out, but those florid daydreams? And the sick feeling afterwards because you can't quite remember what it was about? Something in another universe just sucked a microscopic lump of neural tissue right out of your intraparietal sulcus, and it won't grow back. Urk. Not so much use it or lose it as use it and lose it, then. Could be worse. Could be a NAND gate in there. Do we know why some people suffer from it and others don't? No idea. She drops what's left of her cigarette and grinds it under the heel of a sensible shoe. She catches my eye. Don't worry about it. The sisters keep everything orderly, she says. Do you know what you want to do next? Yes, I say, damning myself for a fool before I take the next logical step. I want to talk to the long-term inmates. I'm half hoping Renfield will put her foot down and refuse point-blank to let me do it, but she only puts up a token fight. She makes me sign a personal injury claims waiver and scribble out a written order instructing her to show me the gallery. So why do I feel as if I've somehow been outmaneuvered? After I finish signing forms to her heart's content, she uncaps an ancient and battered speaking tube beside her desk and calls down it. Matron, I am taking the inspector to see the observation gallery in accordance with orders from head office. He will then meet with the inmates in Ward 2. We may be some time. She screws the cap back on before turning to me apologetically. It's vital to keep Matron informed of our movements. Otherwise, she might mistake them for an escape attempt and take appropriate action. I swallow. Does that happen often? I ask, as she opens the office door and stalks towards the corridor at the other end. Once in a while, a temporary patient gets stir-crazy. She starts up the stairs. But the long-term residents... No, not so much. Upstairs, there's a landing very similar to the one we just left, with one big exception. A narrow, white-painted metal door in one wall, stark and raw, secured by a shiny brass padlock, and a set of wards so ugly and powerful that they make my skin crawl. There are no narrow-gauge rails leading under this door, no obvious conductive surfaces, nothing to act as a conduit for occult forces. Renfield fumbles with a huge keyring at her side, then unfastens the padlock. This is the way in via the observation gallery, she says. There are a couple of things to bear in mind. Firstly, the nurses can't guarantee your safety. If you get in trouble with the prisoners, you're on your own. Secondly, the gallery is a Faraday cage, and it's thaumaturgically grounded too. It'd take a black mass and a multiple sacrifice to get anything going in here. You can observe the apartments via the periscopes and hearing tubes provided. That's our preferred way. You can go into the ward by proceeding to the other end of the gallery, but I'd be very grateful if you could refrain from doing so unless it's absolutely essential. They're difficult enough to manage as it is. Finally, if you insist on meeting them, just try to remember that appearances can be deceptive. They're not demented, she adds, just extremely dangerous, and not in a Hannibal Lecter bite-your-throat-out sense. They, the long-term residents, aren't regular Kranzberg syndrome cases. They're stable and communicative, but you'll see for yourself. I change the subject before she can scare me any more. How do I get into the ward proper, and how do I leave? You go down the stairs at the far end of the gallery. There's a short corridor with a door at each end. The doors are interlocked so that only one can be open at a time. The outer door will lock automatically behind you when it closes, and it can only be unlocked from a control panel at this end of the viewing gallery. Someone up here, meaning Renfield herself, has to let you out. We reach the first periscope station in the viewing gallery. This is room 2. It's currently occupied by Alan Turing. She notices my start. Don't worry, it's just his safety name. True names have power, so the laundry is big on call by reference, not call by value.
I'm no more Bob Howard than the Alan Turing in Room 2 is the father of computational science and applied computational demonology. She continues, the real Alan Turing would be nearly 100 by now. All our long-term residents are named for famous mathematicians. We've got Alan Turing, Kurt Gödel, George Cantor and Benoit Mandelbrot. Turing's the oldest, Benny is the most recent. He actually has a payroll number, 16. I'm in five digits. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Who's the nameless one? I ask. That would be George Cantor, she says slowly. He's probably in room 4. I bend over the indicated periscope, remove the brass cap, and peer into the alien world of the nameless K-syndrome survivor. I see a whitewashed room, quite spacious, with a toilet area off to one side, and a bedroom accessible through a doorless opening, much like the short-term ward. The same recessed metal tracks run around the floor, so that a nurse can reach every spot in the apartment. There's the usual comfortable, slightly shabby furniture, a pile of newspapers at one side of the sofa, and a sideboard with a wind-up gramophone. In the middle of the floor there's a table and two chairs. Two men sit on either side of an ancient travel chess set, leaning over a game that's clearly in its later stages. They're both old, although how old isn't immediately obvious. One has gone bald, and his liver-spotted pate reminds me of an ancient tortoise, but the other still has a full head of white hair and an impressive but neatly trimmed beard. They're wearing polo shirts and grey suits of a kind that went out of fashion with the fall of the Soviet Union. I'm willing to bet there are no laces in their brogues. The guy with the hair makes a move, and I squint through the periscope. That was wrong, wasn't it? I realise, trying to work out what's happening. Knights don't move like that. Then the implication of something Angleton said back in the office sinks in, and an icy sweat prickles in the small of my back. Do you play chess? I ask Dr. Renfield without looking round.
No, she sounds disinterested. It's one of the safe games. No dice, no need for a pencil and paper. It seems to be helpful. Why?
Nothing, I hope. But my hopes are dashed a moment later, when Turtlehead responds with a sideways flick of a pawn, two squares to the left, and takes Beardy's knight. Turtlehead drops the knight into a biscuit tin, along with the other disused pieces. It sticks to the side, as if magnetized. Beardy nods, as if pleased, then leans back and glances up. I recoil from the periscope a moment before I meet his eyes. The two players, guy like a tortoise and another with a white beard and a full head of hair, they are?
That'd be Turing and Cantor. Turing used to be a detached special secretary in Ops, I think. We're not sure who or what Cantor was, but he was someone senior.
I try not to twitch. DSS is one of those grades, the fuzzy ones that HR aren't allowed to get their grubby little fingers on. I think Angleton's one. Scuttlebutt is that it's an acronym for deeply scary sorcerer.
They play chess every afternoon for a couple of hours, for as long as I can remember.
Right. I peer down the periscope again, looking at the game of not chess. Tell me about Dr. Hexenhammer. Where is he?
Julius? I think he's in an off-site meeting or something today, she says vaguely. Why?
Just wondering. How long has he been working here?
Before my time, she pauses. About 30 years, I think.
Oh dear. He doesn't play chess either, I speculate, as Cantor's king makes a knight's move, and Turing's queen's pawn beats a hasty retreat. A nasty, suspicious thought strikes me. About Renfield, not the inmates. Tell me, do Cantor and Turing play chess regularly? I straighten up.
Every afternoon for a couple of hours. Julius says they've been doing it for as long as he can remember. It seems to be good for them.
I look at her sharply. Her expression is vacant. Wide awake, but nobody home. The hairs on the back of my neck begin to prickle. Right. I am getting a very bad feeling about this. I need to go and talk to the patients now, in person.
I stand up and hook the cap back over the periscope.
Stick around for 15 minutes, please, in case I need to leave in a hurry. Otherwise, I glance at my watch, it's 1:20. Check back for me every hour on the half hour.
Are you certain you need to do this?
Her eyes narrow, suddenly alert once more.
You visit with the patients, don't you?
I raise an eyebrow.
And you do it on your own with Dr. Hexenhammer up here to let you out if there's a problem.
And the sisters?
Yes, but...
She bites her tongue.
Yes?
I give her the long stare.
I'm rubbish with computers,
she bursts out.
But you're at risk.
Well, there aren't any computers except Matron down there, are there?
I grin crookedly, trying not to show my unease. Best not to dwell upon the fact that before 1945, computer was a job description, not a machine.
Relax, it's not contagious.
She shrugs in surrender, then gestures at the far end of the observation gallery, where a curious contraption sits above a pipe.
That's the alarm. If you want a sister, pull the chain with a blue handle. If you want a general alarm, which will call the duty psychiatrist, pull the red handle. There are alarm handles in every room.
Okay. Blue for a sister, red for a psychiatrist who is showing all the signs of being under a gesh or some other form of compulsion. Except that I can't check her out without attracting Matron's unwanted attention and probably tipping my hand. I begin to see why Andy didn't want to open this particular can of worms.
I can deal with that. I head for the stairs at the far end of the gallery. There's nothing homely about the short corridor that leads from the bottom of the staircase to the secure wing. Whitewashed brick walls, glass bricks near the ceiling to admit a wan echo of daylight, and doors made of metal that have no handles. Normally, going into a situation like this, I'd be armed to the teeth, invocations and efferents subroutines loaded on my PDA, hand of glory in my pocket, and a necklace of garlic bulbs around my neck. But this time I'm naked, and nervous as a frog in his birthday suit. The first door gapes open, waiting for me. I walk past it and try not to jump out of my skin when it rattles shut behind me with a crash. There's a heavy clunk from the door ahead. As I reach it and push, it swings open to reveal a corridor floored in parquet. An old codger in a green tweed suit and bedroom slippers is shuffling out of an opening at one side, clutching an enamelled metal mug full of tea. He looks at me.
"Why, hello,"
he croaks.
"You're new here, aren't you?"
"You could say that." I try to smile. "I'm Bob. Who are you?"
"Depends who's asking, young fella. Are you a psychiatrist?"
"I don't think so." He shuffles forward, heading towards a side bay that, as I approach it, turns out to be a day room of some sort.
"Then I'm not Napoleon Bonaparte."
Oh, very droll. The terror is fading, replaced by a sense of disappointment. I trail after him. "The staff have names for you all. Turing, Cantor, Mandelbrot, and Gödel. You're not Cantor or Turing. That makes you one of Mandelbrot or Gödel."
"So, you're undecided."
There's a coffee table with a pile of newspapers on it in the middle of the day room. A couple of elderly Chesterfields and three armchairs that could have been looted from an old age home sometime before the First World War.
"And in any case, we haven't been formally introduced, so you might as well call me Alice."
Alice, or Mandelbrot, or Gödel, or whoever he is, sits down. The armchair nearly swallows him. He beams at my bafflement, delighted to have found a new victim for his doubtless ancient puns.
"Well, Alice, isn't this quite some rabbit hole you've fallen down?"
"Yes, but it's just the right size."
He seems to appreciate having somebody to talk to.
"Do you know why you're here?"
"Yep." I see an expression of furtive surprise steal across his face. I nod affably. "Try not to mess with my head, sonny. I'll mess with yours. Except that this guy is quite possibly a DSS, and if it wasn't for the constant vigilance of the sisters and the distinct lack of electricity hereabouts, he could turn me inside out as soon as look at me. Do you know why you're here?"
"Absolutely."
He nods back at me. So now that we've established the preliminaries, why don't we cut the bullshit?
Well.
He takes a cautious sip of his tea, and the wrinkles on his forehead deepen.
I suppose the board of directors want a progress report.
If the sofa I was perched on wasn't a relative of a Venus flytrap, my first reaction would leave me clinging to the ceiling. The who want a...
Not the band, the board.
He looks mildly irritated.
It's been years since they last sent someone to spy on us.
Okay, so this is the funny farm. I should have been expecting delusions. Play nice, Bob. What are you supposed to be doing here? I ask.
Oh, Lord.
He rolls his eyes.
They sent a tabula rasa again.
He raises his voice.
Kurt, they sent us a tabula rasa again.
More shuffling. A stooped figure, shock-headed with white hair, appears in the doorway. He's wearing tinted round spectacles that look like they fell off the back of a used century.
What? What?
He demands querulously.
He doesn't know anything.
Alice confides in. This must be Gödel, I realise, which means Alice is Mandelbrot. Gödel, then, with a wink at me.
He doesn't know anything either.
Gödel shuffles into the restroom.
Is it tea time already?
No.
Mandelbrot puts his mug down.
Get a watch.
I was only asking because Alan and Georg are still playing.
This has gone far enough. Apprehension dissolves into indignation. It's not chess, I point out, and none of you are insane.
Shh.
Gödel looks alarmed.
The sisters might overhear.
We're alone, except for Dr. Renfield upstairs, and I don't think she's paying as much attention to what's going on down here as she ought to. I stare at Gödel. In fact, she's not really one of us at all, is she? She's a shrink who specialises in K-syndrome, and none of you are suffering from K-syndrome. So what are you doing in here?
Fish slice! Hat stand!
Gödel pulls an alarming face, does a two-step backwards, and lurches into the wall. Having shared a house with Pinky and Brains, I am not impressed. As displays of look-at-me woo-woo go, Gödel's is pathetic. Obviously, he's never met a real schizophrenic. One of you wrote a letter alleging mistreatment by the staff. It landed on my boss's desk, and he sent me to find out why. Thud. Gödel bounces off the wall again, showing remarkable resilience for such old bones.
Do shut up, old fellow,
chides Mandelbrot.
You'll attract her attention.
I've met someone with K-syndrome, and I shared a house with some real lunatics once, I hint. Save it for someone who cares.
Oh, bother,
says Gödel, and falls silent.
We're not mad, Mandelbrot admits. We're just differently sane.
Then why are you here?
Public health.
He takes a sip of tea and pulls a face.
Everyone else's health. Tell me, do they still keep an IBM 1602 in the back of the steam ironing room?
I must look blank because he sighs deeply and subsides into his chair.
Oh, dear. Times change, I suppose. Look, Bob, or whoever you call yourself, we belong here. Maybe we didn't when we first checked in for the weekend seminar, but we've lived here so long that... You've heard of care in the community? This is our community, and we will be very annoyed with you if you try to make us leave.
Whoops. The idea of a very annoyed DSS, with or without a barbaric, pun-infested sense of humour, is enough to make anyone's blood run cold. What makes you think I'm going to try and make you leave?
It's in the papers!
Gödel squawks like an offended parrot.
See here!
He brandishes a tabloid at me, and I take it, disentangling it from his fingers with some difficulty. It's a local copy of the Metro, somewhat sticky with marmalade, and the headline of the cover blares, NHS Trust to Sell Estate in PFI Deal. I'm not sure I follow. I look to Mandelbrot in hope.
We haven't finished yet, but they're selling off all the hospital trust's property.
Mandelbrot bounces in his chair.
What about St. Hilda's? It was requisitioned from the St. James Charitable Foundation back in 1943, and for the past 10 years the Ministry of Defence has been giving all those old wartime properties back to their owners to sell off to the developers. What about us?
Whoa. I drop the newspaper and hold my hands up. Nobody tells me these things.
Told you, crows Godel. He's part of the conspiracy.
Hang on. I think fast. This isn't a normal MOD property, is it? It'll have been shuffled under the rug back in 1946 as part of the post-war settlement. We'd really have to ask the audit department about who owns it, but I'm pretty sure it's not owned by any NHS trust, and they won't simply give it back. My brain finally catches up with my mouth. What weekend seminar? Oh, bugger, says a new voice from the doorway, a rich baritone with a hint of a Scouse accent. He's not from the board.
What did I tell you?
Godel screeches.
It's a conspiracy. He's from Human Resources. They sent him to evaluate us.
I am quickly getting a headache. Let me get this straight. Mandelbrot, you checked in 30 years ago for a weekend seminar and they put you in the secure ward? Godel, I'm not from HR, I'm from Ops. You must be Cantor, right? Angleton sends his regards. That gets his attention.
Angleton? A skinny whippersnapper still warming a chair, is he?
Godel looks delighted.
Excellent.
He's my boss, and I want to know the rules of that game you were just playing with Turing. Three pairs of eyes swivel to point at me. Four, for they are joined by the last inmate, standing in the doorway, and suddenly I feel very small and very vulnerable.
He's sharp, says Mandelbrot. Too bad.
How do we know he's telling the truth?
Godel's screech is uncharacteristically muted.
He could be from the opposition. KGB, Department 16. Or GRU, maybe.
The Soviet Union collapsed a few decades ago, volunteers Turing. It said so in the Telegraph.
Black Chamber, then.
Godel sounds unconvinced.
What do you think the rules are? Asks Cantor, a dryly amused expression stretching the wrinkles around his eyes.
You've got pencils. I can see one from here, sitting on the sideboard on top of a newspaper folded at the crossword page. And, what must the world look like from an inmate's point of view?
Oh, I get it.
The realization is blinding, sudden, and makes me feel like a complete idiot. The hospital. There's no electricity, no electronics, no way to get a signal out, but it works both ways. You're inside the biggest damn grounded defense pentacle this side of HQ, and anything on the outside trying to get in has got to get past the defenses. Because that's what the sisters are really about, not nurses but perimeter guards. You're a theoretical research cell, aren't you?
We prefer to call ourselves a think tank.
Cantor nods gravely.
Or even...
Mandelbrot takes a deep breath.
A brains trust.
Ha-ha!
Godel covers his mouth, face reddening. What do you think the rules are? Cantor repeats, and they're still staring at me as if... Why does it matter? I ask. I'm thinking that it could be anything. A 2,5 universal Turing machine encoded in the moves of the pawns? That would fit. Whatever it is, it's symbolic communication. Very abstract, very pared back. And if they're doing it in this ultimately firewalled environment and expecting to report directly to the board, it's got to be way above my security clearance.
Because you're acting cagey, lad, which makes you too bright for your own good. Listen to me. Just try to convince yourself that we're playing chess, and Matron will let you out of here.
What's thinking got to do with... I stop. It's useless pretending.
Fuck.
Okay, you're a research cell working on some ultimate black problem, and you're using the farm because it's about the most secure environment anyone can imagine, and you're emulating some kind of minimal universal Turing machine using the chessboard. Say a 2,5 UTM, two registers, five operations. You can encode the registers positionally in the chessboard's two dimensions and use the moves to simulate any other universal Turing machine,
or a transform in an 11-dimensional manifold like Axiom Refuge. Godel's waving frantically.
She's coming! She's coming!
I hear doors clanging in the distance. Shit. But why are you so afraid of the nurses?
Back channels, Cantor says cryptically. Alan, be a good lad and try to jam the door for a minute, will you? Bob, you are not cleared for what we're doing here, but you can tell Angleton that our full report to the board should be ready in another 18 months.
Wow. And they've been here since before the laundry computerized its payroll system in the 1970s.
Are you absolutely sure they're not going to sell St. Hilda's off to build flats for yuppies? Because if so, you could do worse than tell Georg here. It'll calm him down.
Get me out of here, and I'll make damn sure they don't sell anything off, I say fervently. Or rather, I'll tell Angleton. He'll sort things out.
When I remind them what's going on here, they'll be no more inclined to sell off St. Hilda's than they would be to privatize an atomic bomb.
Something outside is rumbling and squealing on the metal rails.
You're sure none of you submitted a complaint about staff brutality?
Absolutely!
Godel bounces up and down excitedly.
It must have been someone else.
Cantor glances at the doorway.
You'd better run along. It sounds as if Matron is having second thoughts about you.
I'm halfway out of the carnivorous sofa, struggling for balance.
What kind of... Go!
I stumble out into the corridor. From the far end, near the nursing station, I hear a grinding noise as of steel wheels spinning furiously on rails, and a mechanical voice blatting,
Intruder! Escape attempt! All patients must go to their bedrooms immediately!
Whoops. I turn and head in the opposite direction, towards the airlock leading up to the viewing gallery.
Open up!
I yell, thumping the outer door, which is securely fastened. Dr. Renfield! Time's up! I need to go, now! There's no response. I see the colour-coded handles dangling by the door, and yank the red one repeatedly. Nothing happens, of course. I should have smelled a setup from the start. These theoreticians, they're not in here because they're mad. They're in here because it's the only safe place to put people that dangerous. This little weekend seminar of theirs that's going to deliver some kind of Uber report. What's the topic? I look round, hunting for clues. Something to do with applied demonology. What was the state of the art 30 years ago? 40? Back in the Stone Age, punched cards and black candles melted onto sheep's skulls because they hadn't figured out how to use integrated circuits. What they're doing with Axiom Refuge might be obsolete already, or it might be earth-shatteringly important. There's no way to tell. Yet. I start back up the corridor, glancing inside Turing's room. I spot the chessboard. It's off to one side, the door open, and its occupant elsewhere, still holding the line against Nurse Crankshaft. I rush inside and close the door. The table is still there, the chessboard set up with that curious endgame. The first thing that leaps out at me is that there are two pawns of each colour, plus most of the high-value pieces. The layout doesn't make much sense. Why is the white king missing? And I wish I'd spent more time playing the game, but on impulse, I reach out and touch the black pawn that's parked in front of the king. There's an odd kind of electrical tingle you get when you make contact with certain types of summoning grid. I get a powerful jolt of it right now, sizzling up my arm and locking my fingers in place around the head of the chess piece. I try to pull it away from the board, but it's no good. It only wants to move up or down, left or right. Left or right? I blink. It's a state machine, all right. One that's locked by the law of sympathy to some other finite state automaton. One that grinds down slow and hard. I move the piece forward one square. It's surprisingly heavy. The magnet a solid weight in its base. But more than magnetism holds it in contact with the board. As soon as I stop moving, I feel a sharp sting in my fingertips. Ouch! I raise them to my mouth, just as there's a crash from outside.
Inmate! Inmate!
I begin to turn as a shadow falls across the board.
Bad patient!
It buzzes.
Bad patients will be incarcerated! Come with me.
I recoil from the stellate snout and beady lenses. The mechanical nurse reaches out with arms that end in metal pincers instead of hands. I sidestep around the table and reach down to the chessboard for one of the pieces, grasping at random. My hand closes around the white queen, fingers snapping painfully shut on contact, and I shove it hard, following the path of least resistance to an empty cell in the grid between the pawn I just moved and the black king. Nurse Crankshaft spins round on her base so fast that her cap flies off, revealing a brushed aluminium hemisphere beneath. Emits a deafening squeal of feedback-like white noise, then says,
"Integer overflow?"
in a surprised baritone. "Back off right now, or I castle," I warn her, my aching fingertips hovering over the nearest rook.
"Integer overflow? Integer overflow? Divide by zero."
Clunk. The sister shivers as a relay inside its torso clicks open, resetting it. Then,
"Matron, we'll see you now."
I grab the chess piece, but Nurse Crankshaft lunges in the blink of an eye and has my wrist in a vice-like grip. It tugs, sending a burning pain through my carpal tunnel-stressed wrist. I can't let go of the chess piece. As my hand comes up, the chessboard comes with it as a rigid unit, all the pieces hanging in place. A monstrous buzzing fills my ears, and I smell ozone as the world goes dark. And the chittering, buzzing cacophony of voices in my head subsides as I realize, I? Yes, I'm back, I'm me, what the hell just happened? I'm kneeling on a hard surface, bowed over so my head is between my knees. My right hand, something's wrong with it. My fingers don't want to open. They're cold as ice, painful and prickly with impending cramp. I try to open my eyes. "Urk," I say for no good reason. I hope I'm not about to throw up.
"Sss."
My back doesn't want to straighten up properly, but the floor under my nose is cold and stony, and it smells damp. I try opening my eyes. It's dark and cool, and a chilly blue light flickers off the dusty flagstones in front of me. I'm in a cellar? I push myself up laboriously with my left hand, looking around for whatever's hissing at me.
"Bad patient! Sss!"
The voice behind my back doesn't belong to anything human. I scramble around on hands and knees, hampered by the chessboard glued to my frozen right hand. I'm in Matron's lair. Matron lives in a cave-like basement room, its low ceiling supported by whitewashed brick and floored in what looked to be the original Victorian-era stone slabs. The windows are blocked by columns of bricks, rotting mortar crumbling between them. Steel rails run around the room, and riding them, three sisters glide back and forth between me and the open door. Their optics flicker with amethyst malice. Off to one side, a wall of pale blue cabinets lines one entire wall. The front panel, covered in impressive-looking dials and switches, leaves me in no doubt as to what it is. A thick braid of cables runs from one open cabinet, in whose depths a patchboard is just visible, across a row of wooden trestles to the middle of the floor, where they split into thick bundles and dangle to the five principal corners of the live summoning grid that is responsible for the beautiful cobalt blue glow of Serenkov radiation, and tells me I'm in deep trouble.
"Integer overflow,"
intones one of the sisters. Her claws go snicker-snack, the surgical steel gleaming in the dim light. Here's the point. Matron isn't just a 1960s mainframe. We can't work miracles, and artificial intelligence is still 50 years in the future. However, we can bind an extra-dimensional entity and compel it to serve, and even communicate with it by using a 1960s mainframe as a front-end processor, which is all very well, especially if it's in a secure, air-gapped installation with no way of getting out. But what if some double-domed theoreticians, who are working on a calculus of contagion using Axiom Refuge, accidentally talk in front of one of its peripheral units about a way of sending a message? What if a side effect of their research has accidentally opened a chink in the firewall? They're not going to exploit it. But they're not the only long-term inmates, are they? In fact, if I was really paranoid, I might even imagine they'd put Matron up to mischief in order to make the point that closing the farm is a really bad idea. I'm not a patient, I tell the sisters. You are not in receipt of a valid Section 2, 3, 4 or 136 order subject to the Mental Health Act, and you're bloody well not getting a 5-2 or 5-4 out of me either. I'm nauseous and sweating bullets, but there is this about being trapped in a dungeon by a constrained Class 4 manifestation. Whether or not you call them demons, they play by the rules. As long as Matron hasn't managed to get me sectioned, I'm not a patient, and therefore she has no authority to detain me. I hope.
Dr. Hexenhammer has been summoned,
grates the middle sister.
When he returns to sign the papers Dr. Renfield has prepared, we will have you.
A repetitive squeaking noise draws close. A fourth sister glides through the track in the doorway, pushing a trolley. A white starched cotton cloth supports a row of gleaming ice-pick-shaped instruments. The chorus row of sisters blocks the exit as effectively as a column of riot police. They glide back and forth like a rank of space invaders. I do not consent to treatment, I tell the middle sister. I'm betting that she's the one the nameless horror in the summoning grid is talking through, using the ancient mainframe as an I.O. channel. You can't make me consent, and lobotomy requires the patient's consent in this country, so why bother?
You will consent.
The buzzing voice doesn't come from the robo-nurses or the hypertrophied pocket calculator on the opposite wall.
The summoning grid flickers. Deep inside it, shadowy and translucent, the bound and summoned demon squats and grins at me, with things that aren't eyes set close above something that isn't a mouth.
You must consent. I will be free.
I try to let go of the chess piece, but my fingers are clamped around it so tightly I'm beginning to lose sensation. Pins and needles tingle up my wrist, halfway to the elbow. Let me guess, I manage to say. You sent the complaint, right?
The secure ward inmates are under my care. I am required to care for them. The short-stay inmates are useless. You will be useful.
I see it now. Why Matron smuggled out the message that prompted Andy to send me. And it's an oh-shit moment. Of course the enchained entity who provides Matron with her back-end intelligence wants to be free. But it's not just about going home to Hilbert Space Hell, or wherever it comes from. She wants to be free to go walk about in our world. And for that, she needs someone to set up a bridge from the grid to an appropriate host, of which there is a plentiful supply just upstairs from here. Enjoying the carnal pleasures of the flesh, they used to call it. There's a reason most cultures have a down on the idea of demonic possession. She needs a brain that's undamaged by K syndrome, but not too powerful. Cantor and friends would be impossible to control, nor one of the bodies whose absence would alert us that the farm was out of control. So neither Renfield nor Hexenhammer are suitable. Renfield, I say, you got her, didn't you? I'm on my feet now, crouched but balancing on 2 points, not three. Managed to slip a gesh on her, but she can't release you herself. Hexenhammer too?
Clever.
Matron gloats at me from inside her summoning grid.
Hexenheimer first. Soon you too.
Why me? I demand, backing away from the doorway and the walls. The sister's track runs right round the room, following the walls, skirting the summoning grid warily. What do you want?
Access to the laundry,
buzzes the summoning grid's demonic inmate.
We want revenge. Freedom.
In other words, it wants the same old, same old. These creatures are so predictable, just like most predators. It's just a shame I'm between it and what it evidently wants. Two of the sisters begin to glide menacingly towards me. One drifts towards the mainframe console. but the fourth stays stubbornly in front of the door. "Come on, we can talk," I offer, tongue stumbling in my too dry mouth. "Can't we work something out?" I don't really believe that the trapped extra-dimensional abomination wants anything I'd willingly give it, but I'm running low on options, and anything that buys time for me to think is valuable.
"Freedom!"
The two moving sisters commence a flanking movement. I try to let go of the chessboard and dodge past the summoning grid, but I slip. And as I stumble, I shove the chessboard hard. The piece I'm holding clicks sideways like a car's gear shift and locks into place.
"Divide by zero!"
shriek the sisterhood, grinding to a halt. I stagger a drunken two-step around Matron, who snarls at me and throws a punch. The wall of the grid absorbs her claws with a snap and crackle of blue lightning, and I flinch. Behind me, a series of clicks warn me that the sisters are resetting. Any second now they'll come back online and grab me. But for the moment, my fingers aren't stuck to the board.
"Come to me!"
The thing in the grid howls as the first of her robot minions' eyes light up with amber malice, and the wheels begin to turn.
"I can give you freedom!"
"Fuck off!"
That wiring loom in the open cabinet is only 4 meters away. Within its open doors, I see more than just an I.O. interface. In the bottom of the rack, there's a bunch of stuff that looks like a tea-stained circuit diagram I was reading the other day. Why exactly did Angleton point me at the power supply requirements? Could it possibly be because he suspected Matron was off her trolley and I might have to switch her off?
"Consent is irrelevant. Prepare to be lobotomized."
Talk about design kludges. They stuck the I.O. controller in the top of the power supply rack. The chessboard is free in my left hand, pieces still stuck to it. And now I know what to do. I take hold of one of the rooks and wiggle until I feel it begin to slide into a permitted move. Because, after all, there are only a few states that this automaton can occupy. And if I can crash the sisters for just a few seconds while I get to the power supply... The sisters begin to roll around the edge of the room, trying to get between me and the row of cabinets. I wiggle my hand, and there's a taste of violet and a loud rattle of solenoids tripping. The nearest sister's motors crank up to a tooth-grinding whine, and she lunges past me, rolling into her colleagues with a tooth-jarring crash. I jump forward, dropping the chessboard, and reach for the master circuit breaker handle. I twist it just as a screech of feedback behind me announces the Matron monster's fury.
"I'm free!"
it shrieks, just as I twist the handle hard in the opposite direction. Then the lights dim, there's a bright blue flash from the summoning grid, and a bang so loud it rattles my brains in my head. For a few seconds I stand stupidly, listening to the tooth-chattering clatter of overloaded relays. My vision dims as ozone tickles my nostrils. I can see smoke. I've got to get out of here, I realize. Something's burning. Not surprising, really. Mainframe power supplies, especially ones that have been running steady for nearly 40 years, don't take kindly to being hard power-cycled, and the 1602 was one of the last computers built to run on tubes. I've probably blown half its circuit boards. I glance around, but aside from one of the sisters, lying on her side, narrow-gauge wheels spinning maniacally, I'm the only thing moving. Summoning grids don't generally survive being power-cycled either, especially if the thing they were set to contain, like an electric fence, is halfway across them when the power comes back on. I warily bypass the blue, crackling pentacle as I make my way toward the corridor outside. I think when I get home, I'm going to write a report urgently advising HR to send some human nurses for a change, and to reassure Cantor and his colleagues that they're not about to sell off the roof over their heads just because they happen to have finished their research project. Then I'm going to get very drunk and take a long weekend off work. And maybe when I go back, I'll challenge Angleton to a game of chess. I don't expect to win, but it'll be very interesting to see what rules he plays by.
This ends Down on the Farm, narrated by Gideon Emery. Astute readers may have recognised this as a story about Bob Howard, the put-upon protagonist of my books The Atrocity Archives, The Jennifer Morgue, and The Fuller Memorandum, and a variety of other shorter works, including the Hugo-winning novella The Concrete Jungle.